Chunk with Robots, the podcast for news and views in robotics. Hello and welcome to the Robots Podcast, episode number 102. My name is Jana, and today we will continue our visit to the Chunk Open Days, which we started in episode 99 and then interrupted to celebrate the podcast's 100th episode. So today we're back with Amanda, who was invited to the Chunk Open Days and managed to speak, among others, to Steve Cousins and Roland Siegwart. But first, as always, here are the news with Christine.
Thank you. U.S. Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency DARPA has announced a new robotics challenge. Following in the successful footsteps of their grand and urban challenges for autonomous cars, the new challenge calls for the development of robots that can replace humans in disaster areas such as the recent Fukushima nuclear accident, or in military scenarios such as defusing an improvised explosive device. The robots will have to navigate a series of physical tasks, including using tools built for humans, from a wrench to driving a vehicle. The program will award $20 to $30 million in research money to competing teams, plus a $2 million cash prize to the winner. In other news, Boston Dynamics has released a new video of their Petman robot. The DARPA-funded humanoid robot, which you may remember from previous reports, is shown climbing a flight of stairs. During the climb, the robot performs a natural fluid arm motion to touch a nearby wall for support. What makes the video even more impressive is that the stairs are steep and almost knee-high. And finally, the world's first chocolate printer developed by researchers at the University of Exeter has just gone on sale. The 3D printer using chocolate was developed to showcase the wide potential of new 3D printing technologies. And if things go according to the researchers' plans, we will soon be able to create our own custom chocolate designs, from chocolate hearts to chocolate castles online, and have them delivered to our doorstep the next day. For more details on this week's news, including the new DARPA Robotics Challenge, Boston Dynamics Petman climbing stairs, and the 3D chocolate printer, have a look at our website at www.robotspodcast.com.
Steve Cousins is president and CEO of Willow Garage, a company which develops hardware and open source software for personal robotics applications. At the Chunk Days, Amanda spoke to Steve about his company and about the future of service robotics.
Hey, so hi, Steve, and welcome again on Robots.
Hi, Amanda, and thanks for having me back.
Willow Garage is now promoting three robots, the PR2, the Turtlebot, TechSci, and you host Ross, which has now almost 100 repositories and almost 3,000 packages. So it looks like you're spanning a large part of robotics research. And I was wondering, what does this say about the Willow Garage business model?
So we're all about being a catalyst for innovation. We're trying to create a new industry in personal robotics. And one of the things that we do along those lines is to try to spin off companies as we find opportunities. But the rest of the time, what we're doing is working with the community to try to bring forward the day when we'll have more robots in use.
You also mentioned something about being a catalyst for innovation and having a very long-term vision about your business, actually. So maybe you could say a little bit more about that.
So when we look at our return on investment goals for our investors, they're not typical VC kind of goals. Our charter is to come up with impact first and return on capital second. So when we look at, you know, when are we going to actually make money, we don't worry about can we make money in 2 years or in 3 years or even in 5 years. We look at can we start an industry that will be extremely valuable to the world.
One of the topics of this convention is the profitability of service robots. Where do you see the low-hanging fruit in commercialization of service robots?
I thought the talk by Phillips today was really persuasive, that vacuum cleaners, robotic vacuum cleaners, is obviously a low-hanging fruit. For me, the next lowest-hanging fruit is remote presence robots. And I don't know whether you call that service or not, but it's a way to let especially white-collar workers work one place and while they live in a different place. We had an example, I didn't talk about it at this conference, but we have an example of a robot that we call Tex-I that you mentioned. And the Tex-I is about being able to work in one city and while you live in another city. And we've used it across 4,000 miles difference, so sort of bridging a 4,000-mile commute and on a regular basis. And it actually works. It makes a difference to the person who's working remotely in terms of their experience with the company.
So on the same line of thought, what do you think that we might be able to buy first? Remote presence robots or autonomous household helpers or maybe assistive autonomous cars or autonomous garden robots?
I'm confident that the first of the ones you mentioned will be the remote presence robots. There are already some on the market. The company that we spun off to do that should have a product out this year. So that's happening relatively soon. Autonomous cars, I think, are closer than people believe. I took a ride in the Google car and was very impressed. We went 10 miles. We merged into traffic on the highway. We drove through neighborhoods at lunchtime where people are walking around and successfully detected and avoided pedestrians, stopped at stoplights. And so it's a very impressive on a technology side. The challenge there, and the reason I don't think it'll be adopted next year, is that it's a legal challenge, right? Who's responsible when these things have an accident? And they're still in prototype. And the other challenge is that in California on a sunny day, they work great. Mm-hmm. I didn't try this personally, but apparently in the rain, it's a little scary.
Absolutely. It's interesting that you mentioned this because when I was talking to Professor Brodji quite a while back on autonomous cars, he said that agriculture was probably going to be one of the first domains where they're going to kind of commercialize these because of the structured environment. You know exactly what's going to happen. And maybe that's also why telepresence robots are maybe easier to implement because you know what setting you can use them for.
I think those reasons are different. I think you're right that agriculture robots are coming soon, but they're coming soon in an autonomous mode. And there's already, the tractors are very robotic already, they're using localization in order to be very precise. And a lot of times I think the operator of the tractor is just listening to music, doesn't have to pay so much attention because the machine does so much. In the case of remote presence, what's clever there, the intelligence, is the person who's driving it. And the fact that you can avoid going down the stairs because the person's driving it, they can make sure, they can see the stairs. And you don't have to worry about, did my sensors properly detect, the person in front of me? You see the person in front of you. And you design the robot so that it's not so powerful that it's going to run somebody over. But most importantly, you put a human brain inside of it. And it's not the same as trying to do something autonomous.
In that sense, maybe telepresence robots also solves the problem of the acceptance barriers. We saw a talk this afternoon which addressed the stigmatization and also the feeling of surveillance. It nicely overcomes this, actually.
Yeah, in that case, there's a principle of symmetry. If you have somebody who's looking through a robot, but whoever's looking at the robot can see the person on the other side, then it's not the same. Like, for example, if you walk down the hall where my office is, and you poke your head in my office, it's not like you're spying on me. I can see you poking your head in, right? And so it's a symmetric thing. And that's accepted. We don't feel bad if somebody pokes their head in your office. And even if they don't say hi because maybe they see that you're on the phone, you don't feel like you've been spied on. On the other hand, if somebody mounted a camera in my office so that anybody in the company could see whether I'm on the phone or not, but I don't know who's looking at me, that feels different. And so I think that's an important thing. Some of the remote presence robots that are out now have cameras but not screens. And I think those are not going to be well accepted. You might call those spy bots. There's a big difference between a spy bot and a true remote presence robot that lets you be there.
So in that sense, this feeling of being surveyed, monitored, is in your opinion, actually a bit of a big deal, actually.
I think it can be. One of the things that was interesting in the talk this afternoon is that older people didn't seem to worry about it as much as younger people, right? Because at some point, if you're looking at the alternative of going into a nursing home, well, you're giving up a lot of privacy to go in there. And so you might be willing to give up a little bit less privacy to have somebody monitoring you in your home if you know who they are.
Okay, so let me just change the subject a little bit. I wanted to talk about this year's ICRA Robot Challenge, which is going to happen in May. So, yeah, I'll just let you talk about it a bit.
So, the ICRA Robot Challenge is something that I was asked to organize this year. And there's actually four or five different challenges going on. Some of them are challenges that have gone on for the past few years. But the one I want to tell you about is a new one. That's a mobile manipulation challenge. And there was a mobile manipulation challenge, I think, 2 or 3 years ago. And we're bringing it back, but in a very specific way. I called it the challenge Yesterday's Sushi, which is sort of a funny name for a restaurant. You wouldn't want to eat there. And the idea is that the robot will come into this restaurant, and the restaurant is set up in a typical way. Like if you walk into a sushi restaurant, you don't have a map in your head of how the tables are going to be arranged, right? You go in and you figure it out. And in this challenge, the robot needs to do the same thing. Come into the restaurant. There's four different pieces of furniture. There's a table where you eat, and you know that because it's sort of in the middle and there's chairs around it potentially. There's another table that's alongside a wall, and you can recognize that's designated as the dirty dishes area. Think of it like a counter, but just for simplicity, it's a table along the wall. There's another, like a bookshelf or some kind of a cabinet, a cupboard that holds the clean dishes. And then there's a rotating table. That's why we call it a sushi restaurant. Kind of gets at that sushi boat idea where things are moving around. And that will have plates of sushi and maybe other drinks or condiments on it, but they're moving. And as a challenge, it's interesting because what the robot's supposed to do is first come in and clear the table, which is a static table. It's got objects on it. You had to detect, you know, where the table was, and then you have to move everything that's on that table onto the dirty dishes area. So that's a static table to another static table. It should be the simplest case. Then you have to do something that at the last IROS conference people asserted was very difficult, which is to set the table. And so you have to go over, it's a little bit harder motion planning problem to pick things off of shelves. You have to actually classify the objects properly, where in the first phase you just have to pick up everything that's, you know, that's not the table and move it. Now you actually have to figure out that this is a plate, this is a bowl, this is a cup, and pick one of each and set a place setting. And then the third part is challenging because if you've watched robots plan recently, what they do is they come up to whatever planning situation they're in, they stare at it for a while, and then they start acting. And if everything's moving, that is not going to work so well. You're going to have to at least understand the motion and plan for that. And so I think that challenges the motion planning in an interesting way. I mean, you could have more challenging motion planning problems, but that's a pretty good start. And so that's the third piece of it. So you serve the sushi from there. We're trying to see how much you can do in a certain period of time. And this is a challenge versus a contest. And it's a challenge because I don't expect anybody to solve it this year. Right, there. Hopefully, we'll solve it over the next, 2 to 5 years. But this year, we're going to see where we are, and next year, we'll get a benchmark and see how much we improved as a community. Willow Garage will bring PR2s there. People are welcome to use. Other robots are welcome as well. So it's not about the robot; it's about can we solve this problem. Now, we tested this a couple times. So I built yesterday's sushi in Willow Garage just as a little sample area, and first we tried doing it with a remote operator on the PR2, and we were able to do it the first time using a human in the loop. And the challenge is autonomous, but with human in the loop, we were able to do it. And on the first try, we did it in 40 minutes. So I thought that was pretty good. Then I explained the challenge just as I just did, and I asked somebody to try it, and it took him 1 minute and 5 seconds. Okay, so we're off by a significant margin from what's possible. And like anything in robotics, I think the real solution will probably be mixed mode autonomy. Even if you allow a human in the loop, if you actually try to get it down to under 2 minutes, you're going to need a lot of autonomy. You can't be just, doing everything manually with the robot, because it's just not the same as, it's not really an extension of your body at this point. No robots are that good. And so however we get down to solving this, either purely autonomously or solving it with a human in the loop, but in a very short period of time, comparable to human time, either way, we're going to make a lot of progress in the field.
What do you predict will be the insights of this challenge?
I would say that, you know, the thing that I noticed right off the bat is that the actual dishes matter, right? I've had people tell me that they think they can solve this if you just put, you know, AR tags on all the dishes so that you solve the perception problem. The rest of it they think is easy, right? I'll believe it when I see it, because I think robotics problems are always a little harder than we first estimate. But if it does turn out to be that we can solve it except for perception, then we've understand, okay, these are the perception problems we have to solve. Let's work on those. I think the problem is interesting because it generalizes. The rotating table generalizes to an assembly line. The moving things off of table generalizes to lots of home-based tasks people talk about, clearing the dishes and so forth. And so once we can solve this problem, we then have a nice foundation for solving other problems, both in the home and in industry.
Okay, so on that note, thank you very much, Steve, for being with us.
Thanks, Amanda.
Professor Roland Siegwart is Vice President of Research and Industrial Relations at ETH Zurich. He also leads the Autonomous Systems Lab, which aims to create robots and intelligent systems that are able to autonomously operate in complex and diverse environments. Amanda asked him about industry-academia relations and the role of robotics in Switzerland.
Hi, Roland. It's great to have you back on Robots.
It's always a pleasure for me.
You have overseen the creation of several spin-off companies in the last 10 years, and you're now Vice President of the Research and Industrial Relations at the ETH in Zurich. So in this context, you have gotten a broad and concrete view of the interplay between industry and academia. And my question is, in what areas and technologies do you predict the next robotics startups?
I think it's in the area which is probably a little bit less service robotics, probably more service for industry, where the bigger market is there. In these fields, you can actually pay quite much more for a robot. Surveillance and these fields are pretty much booming at the moment now. There is a small spin-off company which started a couple of years ago in Germany about Ascending Technology, for example, and they are up to about 20 people now in 2 or 3 years. Mm-hmm.
Where do you see the potential in terms of different technologies?
I think we should probably not go too far and try to use what we already have. So there is a lot of sensing technology which allows us today to have fully autonomous navigation in specific environment. We cannot do everything, and we should try really to find a market where we can apply what we already can do today reliably.
So I was wondering, and I've been touching upon this several times with different interviewees, many people have this feeling that the more structured the environment is, the more it actually presents a feasible environment for us to apply our robotic technology. Then I was wondering, okay, so what does this say about the application space on one side? And on the other side, does this actually mean that we should also consider actually modifying the environment, like adding certain, you know, it could be tags or whatever, to make it feasible for our applications? I don't know what your opinion is on that.
I think if you can make something reliable by changing the environment without too much of effort, I think it's worth to do it. It's not that we should take everything which we can get. On the other side, I think we probably have also to understand that artificial systems are not exactly good in the same environment that we are. For example, in a forest or an airplane flying over the forest, we can do pretty good navigation and localization with air vehicles. Humans could not do it at all without GPS. Yeah. So interestingly, robots have other perception, even if they have sensors like cameras, but the cameras and what you can see in the cameras and what you can perceive is quite different. And probably you have to learn also more about understanding more what is the best environment for robots, which is probably not the same as for humans.
And if I would now say, you know, what about autonomous cars? Google recently, you know, made a patent which actually did involve modifying the actual environment to help out in this. Do you think that might be a market where we will see changing the environment to make it easier?
I don't believe in full autonomous cars, but I think that cars will get more and more technology inside, which is robotics technology, which helps to make the car safer. And of course, changing the environment is absolutely an option, which is already more or less done. On freeways, you have also special markers on the street. Why not adapting these markers to the needs of making the cars more safe?
Mm-hmm. And what do you think is the role of universities in general?
I think we have to come up with the crazy ideas. We can trigger new directions and then find the best partners to go beyond this and do really innovation, which means that we need something which then has success on the market. But of course, universities are not there to do the whole path. But the earlier you get in contact with the market players and with industry, the more successful and faster the technological transfer can be.
So basically you're saying two-phase kind of thing. First comes the vision, you drive it, and then comes the closing the gap phase.
Yes, but it's important probably already early in the vision where you should involve industry partner, you should discuss with them, because this helps you to probably develop technologies then which can much faster be used in industry.
So Switzerland has just kicked off its National Center of Competence and Research for Robotics. How does this change the landscape of robotics in Switzerland?
I think it generates interactions, and interaction with a lot of different people which have different views, and typically different views create new ideas. And I think this is probably the strongest added value, that people are somewhat pushed to talk to each other in a regular timeline.
What is the state of robotics in Switzerland today? Would you say it's strong?
I typically claim that it's extremely strong. I think we have with EPFL and ETH Zurich two extremely strong universities which have top researchers in the field. And interestingly, we have also quite a lot of startup companies in the field which are still pretty small but which are ready to take off as soon as the markets are well developed and the technology is ready.
What do you think is the area where Switzerland will make its greatest impact in, let's say, the next decade?
Switzerland is a small country and is also a place for small and medium-sized enterprises. And I think this is important to understand. I think we hopefully may make an impact on rather niche markets where high technology is important, but also high precision of production and systems is important. This can be, for example, inspection technology. This can probably also be flying robots, where all these elements come together.
Okay, so in our last interview with you, you mentioned that in order to tackle the future's problems, we have to have a precise definition of our needs and that wasn't really solved yet. Has robotics research made any progress at all on this front?
I'm not so sure. So I think it's still a major issue. And it comes back to this idea that we have to speak with the people which understand the market or the potential market. It's not so easy because the markets are sometimes very often not around. But you have to understand what could be the potential market and speak with the people. And this can only be done not by thinking about it. You have to discuss with people. We have to discuss with potential clients, with industrial partners.
I've seen that you're starting to work on legged robots. And I was wondering what actually distinguishes legged robots from the typical approach, wheel robots, etc.?
I think legged robots give an opportunity to be much more better in different type of environment. Mm-hmm. But on the other side, it's a very interesting and fascinating research field. Mm-hmm. Because with legs, you have to care much more about energy. How can you actually restore energy after touchdown? You have a very complex design task, how to do legs. Mm-hmm. You can get a lot of inspiration from nature and from humans, and I think all this makes this field extremely exciting.
So do you think that the insights you'll get there will pay off for the effort you have to put into the research?
At least for up to now, it pays off for having a lot of very enthusiastic students which are involved in this project. But I think it will also pay off in probably a lot of other fields, because what we learned there with this serial elastic actuators can be useful in a couple of other applications, like, for example, suspension of cars, prosthetics, and so on. And we are also there discussing with motor manufacturers in Switzerland, which are getting interested in this, because they see a potential for this technology to be applied for many other things.
Mm. Okay, great, excellent. So thank you very much for being with us on Robots.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
And that's it for today. As always, more information and all our past episodes can be found on our website at robotspodcast.com. We'll be back in 2 weeks' time. Until then, goodbye. Shunk with Robots, the podcast for news and views in robotics.